This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
And this week, we are on episode 59, where we are covering the yogurt shop murders.
In December of 1991, Austin, Texas would forever be changed with the yogurt shop murders. Four teenage girls were working at the local I Can't Believe It's Yogurt shop when they were murdered, and the building was then set on fire in attempt to hide the crime. To this day, the case remains unsolved despite it being deemed the murder that made Austin lose its innocence.
Yes. And this is like one of those cases that is really interesting to me. It's one of those that definitely feels like it should be solved.
Exactly. And it's definitely one of my favorites. I was really excited to do this one.
Yeah. Before we get into the episode, do you have something you're binging this week, Sarah?
I do. And I actually used to binge it a couple years ago, and I just got back into it again. And it's a YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a guy named Barry Lewis.
Okay.
And it's L-E-W-I-S, that way, Lewis. And the channel used to be called My Virgin Kitchen when I watched it. And he changed it to just his name. And basically, he started the channel in 2011 when he had no idea how to cook or do anything like that. So he called it My Virgin Kitchen. And he would just post like him trying to cook and failing. And then he started doing like different kitchen gadgets and kitchen hacks and stuff like that. And that's mainly what it is now, with like a couple of recipes in between.
Yeah.
But after like so many years, he changed it to his name because he was like, I'm not a virgin in the kitchen anymore. Like, I know what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just fun. You do see a lot of like, he has like 40 or 50, 30 minute long like testing kitchen gadget videos.
Yeah.
And he's from England and he has this tiny little wife. Their relationship is just so wholesome.
Yeah.
And I love it. And they're just very cute, very funny. He tells a lot of like really cheesy dad jokes. And he also like he has a podcast, which I haven't listened to yet. But he's just doing his damn thing. And it's just it's funny and it's awesome. And like, I've obviously been cooking a lot more since we've been home and everything.
Yeah.
So watching these little like gadget videos has been super cute.
Yeah. It's a way to pass the time.
Exactly. And what are you binging this week, Morgan?
I am binging the TV limited series called Little Fires Everywhere.
Okay.
And I read the book. It's actually right there. I'm looking at it. By Celeste Ng, like last year sometime. And I really enjoyed the book. It was really good. So I was like, let's give it a shot. And it has Kerry Washington and Reese Witherspoon as like the leads. So you know it's going to be a fucking good show.
Hell yeah.
But I started actually watching it like, I don't even remember, like when it first came out. And then I watched an episode or two. And I couldn't get into it, but I was like, I want to know what they do with it. So I watched it, and I still have 30 minutes left in the last episode, so I don't know how it ends. It could be a fucking horrible show. I don't know. It could end terribly, but hopefully it ends like the book did. But yeah, it's pretty good. I kind of find Reese Witherspoon, like, I love her. But it's the same character she just played in the HBO show, Big Little Lies.
Okay.
This woman who has to control everything around her to the point where she's like butting into people's lives and just kind of an awful person. Realistically, she's much more awful in this show than she is in Big Little Lies. But it's fine. She just needs to stop taking those roles because it's making her look some type of way. But it's really good. It's a story of two families, and it's mostly like a story about motherhood, in my opinion. Like, pitting these families against each other, but it's like the moms who are doing so because they're trying to protect their own children mm-hmm. while like fighting society at the same time. It's really interesting. I'm not intelligent enough to talk about it, to be completely honest, but it's a good show, and it's on Hulu and Amazon Prime, I think. So okay, there's awesome. Like multiple opportunities to watch it, and it's only 8 episodes, so
yeah,
get it done. Should we just get into the episode?
I guess so. I think it's going to be a little bit of a longer one, so we might as well start it.
Yeah. All right. Let's get into it. And the sources for today are obviously a ton of different articles, but we also listen to some podcasts like Crime Junkie, True Crime Chronicles, and Unresolved. We're going to start by telling you a little bit about all of the girls before we get into the story. So up first is Amy Leigh Ayers, who was born on January 31st in 1978 to parents Robert and Pam Ayers. She was one of two children and had an older brother named Sean. Growing up in Texas, Amy fully embraced the country lifestyle. She loved country music and especially George Strait.
Yeah, I read that she had like the biggest crush on him.
She also loved animals growing up, like cats and horses. And she'd actually been riding horses since the age of 3, which is crazy because they're yeah. like so big.
I am terrified of horses as an adult.
You should be. Honestly, horses have so much power in legs. Like, that's insane. They're crazy. Her brother participated in FFA, which is Future Farmers of America, but Amy didn't need too much encouragement to join. She had even taken to regularly wearing a cowboy hat to school, and her father would describe her as all cowgirl. So she just fully loved it.
Yeah, she was living that country lifestyle. Yeah.
Amy was the youngest out of the girls, but she was friends with Jennifer, Eliza, and Sarah through FFA. And although Amy was attending Burnett Middle School, the chapter she was a member of was held at the Lanier High School, where she was a junior member. Her intention was to become the vice president when she fully became a high school member. Out of the girls, her and Sarah Habison were the closest, and I assume because they're the closest in age. And the two girls didn't get to see each other too much, so they were planning on having a sleepover the first weekend of December to hang out and catch up. And what I like about Amy is that, like, she knows what she wants, and she is like, I'm going to be the vice president when I go to school. Like,
yep.
She just has that vibe to her. Like, she has this plan, and she's going to do it.
Mm-hmm. So the next girl we're going to talk about is Eliza. And Eliza Hope Thomas was born on May 16th, 1974, to parents James and Maria Thomas. She grew up in the Austin area and had a sister named Sonora, which is a really cute name. In 1981, Eliza's parents separated and filed for divorce. Her dad, who was a social worker, got remarried to a woman named Norma Fowler, who was a professor at the University of Texas. And the sisters would split their time between their parents. Eliza went to McCallum High School throughout her sophomore year, but transferred to Lanier High School so she could get involved in their FFA chapter. She loved animals and had even planned on becoming a veterinarian. In fact, she loved animals so much that she would even keep like crayfish and rats in her room. And her father said that he thought that these animals were like ugly and gross and
yeah.
stuff. But it proved that she cared for any animal, no matter how big or small or fluffy
yeah.
or ugly.
The interesting thing that I got from this story is that FFA is like actually a more significant program than I thought.
Yeah.
Because Sarah and I went to the same middle school, and our school literally had a farm attached to it in mm-hmm. the front that people would do FFA at. And like growing up, I was just always like, they're like dorks who like animals, but like,
yeah, like they're
it's
just
actually
picking up cow poop.
Yeah, like it was just like something they did because they were rednecks is what I thought truthfully. Mm-hmm. And it's like actually a very good program from what I've learned in this story. Maybe it's not anymore, and it was in the 70s. Who's to say?
So Eliza's involvement in FFA also brought her close to Jennifer. They were friends and would eventually both be nominated for FFA Queen in their senior year. So she got a job at I Can't Believe It's Yogurt. And also, I looked it up.
Yeah.
And that is like the first one before, like it came before I Can't Believe It's Not Butter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think like this was the beginning of the yogurt phase.
Yes.
The frozen yogurt thing that like no one has still gotten over.
Oh, yeah. The yogurt shop was in the Hillside Center strip mall, and she earned enough money that she was able to purchase her first vehicle, a 1971 Volkswagen Karmann Ghia. This car became her pride and joy. And even though it was a bright green, she loved it.
Yeah, I heard everyone like thought the color was horrible, but she was like, I love this color.
Eliza was also really skilled in anything mechanical, excelling in the school's welding and small engine repair classes. And she would often use her free time to work on fixing up her car.
Yeah.
After she worked at the yogurt shop for a few months, she managed to convince her best friend Jennifer to apply as well. Eliza would have a few weeknight shifts, but her and Jennifer would typically close up the shop on the weekends, which allowed the girls to have lots of time to hang out.
Yeah. Okay, so for the next portion, we are going to be discussing Jennifer and Sarah together, simply because they're sisters.
Yep.
So they had a very similar childhood growing up. Jennifer Ann Harbison was born May 9th, 1974, to Mike and Barbara Harbison. A couple years later, a younger sister was born, Sarah Louise, on October 28th, 1976. Sarah Louise is like a very cute, you know, like...
It is.
Like a little together name.
Better than Sarah Ann, which is mine.
It's just like, your name is Sarah Harris. Why couldn't they have given you some differentiating middle name?
I know. I have the most common name on the freaking planet.
Like, I just want to fight your parents for you. Give me some type of different name.
So my mom said that she named me, like, because of a couple reasons.
Yeah.
But, like, one of the things that she named me after was something called Sarah Plain and Tall, and I was like, so you destined me to be like a plain ass person.
That was her intention all along.
Honestly, she's like, if she's got this plain ass name, she won't get into trouble.
Yeah.
She won't do anything crazy.
There
she
it is.
Be at home.
That's how you plan out your kids.
Exactly. Give them the most basic names.
Back to the story. The girls started their lives living in Texarkana, but when Jennifer was 5 and Sarah was 2, their parents separated and the girls went to live with their mother in Austin, Texas. Their mother eventually remarried to a computer technician named Frank Sirachi, and he went by Skip. And their father lived in New Boston, Texas, where he also remarried to a woman named Debbie. And even though their father lived about 5 hours away, his relationship with the girls remained pretty close. Both girls attended a private middle school, St. Louis Catholic Church, but they knew that they wanted to go to a public high school afterwards in order to have a real-life teenage experience. Jennifer, being the older sibling, graduated from middle school first and went on to attend Lanier High School. In her time at Lanier, Jennifer competed on the school's track team, served as a student speaker of the house for student council, and eventually went on to become the president for the school's chapter of the FFA.
So, like, she was busy AF.
Yeah, very busy. Like, all of these girls yep. were just full to the brim with stuff to do.
I did nothing in after-school activities.
We were literally in the same club together, Sarah.
We were in two clubs together, let's be honest. I just feel like I did nothing.
Yeah, because, like, realistically, we didn't do a ton, but we were still in after-school activities.
Yeah,
we just weren't, like, this crazy.
I feel like because I didn't do any sports that it doesn't count, but it, like, 100% counts.
Yeah. Okay. So, Her classmates said that Jennifer was always opinionated and was never afraid to speak what was on her mind. And she would also tell a bunch of corny jokes. Her geography teacher said she brought joy into the classroom. She was more excited about life than any kid I'd ever known. She was one of the best that Lanier has ever had. In her senior year of high school, Jennifer decided to get a job to prepare for college and help make the payments on a Chevy S10 pickup truck that her father had bought for her. So she got a job at an Albertsons store, but soon after decided to go to work at I Can't Believe It's Yogurt after Eliza told her how much she loved working there. When Jennifer was a senior, her younger sister Sarah graduated from middle school with a humanitarian scholarship and finally became a freshman at Lanier High School. Sarah was an excellent student and, like her sister, became involved in numerous activities at the school. In her freshman year, she was on the school's volleyball and basketball teams, the leader of the JV cheerleading squad, a student council representative, and was also a member of the student of the school's chapter of FFA, also a busy lady.
Oh, yeah.
The school's principal said about Sarah, she had already established herself as assertive and enthusiastic, a vital member of the freshman class. She was a leader, clearly a kid who was going to make a mark on the place.
So, on Friday, December 6, 1991, the girls all left school and were planning a sleepover at Sarah and Jennifer's house. After school, 17-year-old Jennifer went to her boyfriend's apartment to hang out for a few hours before having to work the closing shift at the yogurt shop.
Yeah.
She returned home around 7 p.m., got ready for work, and her sister Sarah, who was 15 at the time, got into the car. On her way to work, she picked up Sarah's friend Amy, who was 13, and dropped the two off at the North Cross Mall, which was just down the street from the yogurt shop, and this is where the girls wanted to spend their evening.
Yeah. I mean, who didn't just walk around the mall as a teenager? What else are you going to do?
That was my, like,
yeah,
from the 8th grade to the 10th grade, that's every all. Friday night.
Yeah, that's all you did. And you didn't, like, actively do anything
No.
other than just walk around the mall. Like, I barely ever even went inside a store.
Yeah.
Like, we just walked around. It made no sense.
I met one of my high school boyfriends by I was waiting for my dad to pick me up with one of my friends, and we were like, well, let's walk the outside of the mall, so when my dad's there, we're already outside and we
right.
can just tell him which entrance we're at.
Yeah.
And then, like, this group of kids, like, we're also walking around the outside and we just, like, met up, and that's how I got one of my high school boyfriends.
Honestly, impressive. Because as an adult woman, I could never.
Oh, no. I'm like, you're a stranger. Do not talk to me.
That's fantastic.
And so for Sarah and Amy, this was actually the first time that they got to go to the mall alone without the supervision of parents or Jennifer. So they were, like, super stoked about
this.
Yeah,
of course you would be.
And the plan after the mall was to go to the yogurt shop when it was closing up and get a ride back home with Jennifer for the sleepover. So Jennifer, after dropping the girls off at the mall, made it to the yogurt shop for her 8 o'clock shift. And she happened to be closing up the shop with her best friend Eliza, who was also 17 at the time. And Eliza had gotten there at 7 p.m. Around 9 o'clock, Jennifer took a small break and drove down the street to pick up Sarah and Amy from the mall. When she brought them back, the younger girls went to a nearby pizza shop called Mr. Gotti's Pizza, where they bought a pizza and brought it back to the yogurt shop to eat.
And I think it was in, like, the same strip mall as them that they just had to walk a couple doors down.
Around 9:30 p.m., Eliza's mother, Maria, came to the shop just to check in on things. And apparently this was kind of like a regular thing for her to do, as well as some of the other parents.
And I'm glad that someone checked in on these teenagers, because why are we allowing teenagers to close a store without anybody else?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, we used to close a store when we were like 18, And I was terrified then, and I was legally an adult.
Yeah, like we literally wouldn't even take out the trash at night because we were too afraid to.
Exactly.
So, like, underage girls just seems, even if it was boys, I'm not saying just girls, but because it's girls, no one under the age of 18 should be working in an establishment by themselves to close for the evening or even with another person under the age of 18.
Exactly, because you also have to deal with, like, A, it's at night.
Yeah.
B, it's 11 o'clock when they close. It's not like they close at, like, 8.
Yeah, and no one else in the strip stayed open as late as the yogurt shop, so no one else was in the strip by 11 p.m. except for these girls.
Yeah, and C, they're dealing with money.
Yeah.
So, Maria's at the shop. She chats for a few minutes with the girls, grabs some froyo, and then left as everything seemed fine. And she was the only other person in this shop at the time when she visited. The shop, like we said, was set to close at 11 p.m. And the final sale registered for the evening occurred at 10:42 p.m. And the girls typically locked the front doors at around 10:50 as a way to indicate that they were closing for the night. They would then clean up and head out. And with Sarah and Amy there as well, the girls would have help cleaning up, meaning that they could possibly even leave earlier.
Yeah, that was probably, like, the goal.
Oh, yeah. The girls started cleaning the machines, putting the chairs up on the tables, filling the napkin dispensers, typical cleaning duties for, like, a restaurant-type shop. 11 o'clock came and went, and as it became closer to midnight, the parents weren't even worried yet that the girls hadn't come home. And this was because the shop had to be fully closed, and the girls also had a habit of going to check on the animals at the offsite FFA location.
Yeah, like their parents said they were expecting them to be a little later because they usually went in the morning and evening to see them, and were just like, yeah, they're probably visiting their animals.
Exactly.
Troy Gray was an officer with the APD, and he was just out patrolling just before midnight when he noticed that there was smoke coming from the yogurt shop in the strip mall. He called into dispatch at 11:47 p.m. to report the fire. And everyone believed it was just a simple kitchen fire, but there wasn't a whole lot going on, so the call got an immediate response from the local fire and police stations. They were just like, we have nothing else to do tonight, let's go over.
I mean, that's a good thing.
It is a good thing, for sure. Firefighters were able to gain control of the flames pretty quickly once arriving, as it was considered to be only a 2-alarm fire. And this means that while one should be cautious putting out the fire, it wasn't totally out of control yet. Mm-hmm. But the firefighters were unaware that they should be looking for a crime scene. Again, they just thought it was a simple kitchen fire, so they just sprayed water everywhere they needed to in order to put the fire out. But as they were putting out the fire, a horrible discovery was made. As they made their way through the shop, a single foot was seen. One of the firefighters who was there that night has said that any time he thinks about the fire, the first thing he remembers is seeing the foot. After this, the nude dead bodies of the four girls were found. When the initial call came into the station, it was just said that two bodies were found. Then later, they called and changed it to three, and by the time the sergeant arrived on scene, the fourth body had been discovered. When Detective Sergeant John Jones entered the scene, the first thing he said was, "Holy shit." John Jones was actually being followed that evening by a film crew.
Yeah, and so, like, they have video of him getting the call and, like, arriving on scene and stuff. I don't think they went inside. Mm-hmm. But they have, like, that kind of crucial video.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy that it just happened to coincide with that evening.
Mm-hmm.
The girls had been bound and gagged with their own clothing. Sarah's arms were bound with a pair of panties, and she had been gagged. And she had also been raped. Jennifer's hands were not bound, but they were placed behind her back. And Eliza also had her hands tied behind her back and was gagged. There was also an ice cream scoop placed between the legs of one of the girls. They had all been shot in the head, execution style, with a .22 caliber lead bullet. The police were able to identify the girls by by Jennifer and Eliza's cars being the only ones in the parking lot, and Sarah and Amy were identified through the process of elimination. A lead investigator later described the scene, saying, "For a long time, I shut out what I saw. Just wholesale carnage. We knew immediately that they were kids." Sarah and Eliza's bodies were stacked on top of one another, and Jennifer's body was right next to theirs, as if it was stacked and had fallen off or been disturbed, and Amy's body was just a little ways away. Unlike the other girls, Amy had been shot twice. The first bullet was a .22 caliber and was shot into the side of her head, but it had missed her brain. And the second bullet, which came from a larger .380 caliber bullet, caused severe damage to her brain and exited out through her cheek. She also had a big bruise on her chin as if she had been hit, and it appeared as though she had also been strangled before being shot. Amy had also been raped.
And, like, just as a side note, they did say that the two girls were sexually assaulted, but they didn't rule out that the other two girls weren't, because their bodies may have been too badly burned to be able to tell if they were raped or sexually assaulted.
Right. And it is believed that Amy's body had also been stacked on top of the other girls, but that she was still alive at the time the fire started and managed to start crawling towards the front door when she died. Her body also only had second-degree burns on it, and this would also explain why Jennifer's body was disturbed and knocked off the pile. The other girls' bodies were completely charred to the point that the officers couldn't identify the girls, including not being able to identify their gender, race, or age at first. And not wanting to get too graphic, we'll just say that the fire was so hot that certain body parts and jewelry that should not have melted ended up melting.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was, like, localized to them pretty much.
Yes.
Police determined that a lot of the forensic evidence had been lost due to the fire and water. So instead of sending the bodies to the medical examiner's office right away and risk losing more evidence, police had rape kits conducted on the bodies while they were still at the scene.
And this is, like, super against protocol. Yeah. And stuff.
I feel like they do a lot of weird things in this case that are, like, against protocol.
Yeah. And also, you know, it was in the 90s, so it wasn't as, like, strict, I feel like, as it is now.
Yeah, I think that's a bad excuse, personally.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that it was also just a matter of no one expected that to be the scene they walked into.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, what the fuck? Like, and had no idea how to handle it from there. And it's, like, kind of a shame because these girls deserve an answer and the police just didn't do their job.
Yeah, and, like, a lot of the other podcasts were saying that, like, at this time, Austin was still, like, on the smaller side, mm-hmm. and the homicide department had never dealt with anything this
yeah.
big.
And the homicide department literally had 6 people yeah. working on it, so it wasn't great.
No. And, like, they 100% should have, like, called in help from the state police or something
yeah.
like that, but
they didn't.
They
panicked.
Tried to handle it on their own.
Yeah.
yeah.
The autopsy reports, along with many details of the crime, were sealed and kept from the public, as the details were very gruesome and to help keep out false confessions.
This crime shocked the city of Austin, and an investigation immediately began. It even shocked the police department themselves. Sergeant Scott Carey is quoted as saying, "I've been on the force 10 years and lived in Austin 20 years, and this is the worst I remember." At the crime scene itself, it was discovered that the back door had been unlocked. Police believe that this is how the killer got away, as the front door had been locked and the keys to the shop would later be found inside. An audit of the shop would later determine that about $540 had been stolen. And the last sale registered occurred at 11:03 p.m., and it had been a no sale. So they pressed, like, the no sale button, so the register just opened.
Right.
And so that way they can get the money out. A full arson investigation was also launched. It was determined that the fire started in the kitchen area. And official reports say it began at approximately 11:42 p.m., just 39 minutes after the no sale transaction was made on the register.
It's crazy that they think it was set at 11:42 and it was called in at 11:47 and the girls were that badly burned already.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's, that's just crazy.
It was theorized that the fire was set by the perpetrators by setting styrofoam cups full of lighter fluid either on or near the bodies.
Yeah. It was never confirmed, though. That's just a theory.
I also, in the Crime Junkie episode, she said that in an arson case, they're supposed to do like swabs of the outside of the body to see if an accelerant was used. And they never did it in this case. Right? Through speaking with witnesses, the police were able to create a clear picture of what occurred before the murder. Between 8:15 and 8:30, a woman named Lucella Jones came into the shop to pick up some yogurt for her husband and would recall seeing two teenage boys sitting in a booth near the front door. They were the only two customers in the shop at the time, but they didn't have any frozen yogurt in front of them, and they seemed to be, like, too busy with whatever they were playing with that was on the table in between them, which seemed to be some sort of, like, bag or sack, and she thought it contained either, like, change or marbles or something that could be, like, fiddled with.
Mm-hmm.
She described the boys as having long, unkempt hair, and that they gave her a sense of unease, and she also said that the boys had, like, a darker skin tone. Multiple people would confirm that they saw Amy and Sarah eating pizza in the lobby of the shop later in the evening. Sometime between 9:30 and 10 p.m., Daryl Croft would stop by with some friends. And we read in some places that he was a member of law enforcement, so he may or may not be.
And others said that he had been an ex-member of law enforcement. Mm-hmm.
They noticed two separate younger couples and an individual man who was alone. He described this young man as having a deep voice, a large nose, and was pretty fidgety. He said that this man acted weird, like he didn't know what to order, and he kept letting people in line go in front of him. The man then asked Croft to go in front of him, to which Croft answered, "No, you can go." So the man walked up to the counter and ordered a single can of soda that he took with him to the bathroom. And the bathroom is, like, actually right by the entrance to the back room of the store. And Croft stayed for a few more minutes after this, but the man never came out of the bathroom before he left.
Yeah. So like we said before, the final sale of the night occurred at 10:42. And this sale was with a couple who had stopped to get dessert after a movie and decided to eat it at the shop. This couple reported seeing two men sitting at the booth closest to the register and farthest from the door. They were both in jackets or sweatshirts that obscured their faces, and the man with his back to the door was in a big puffy tan jacket. One appeared to be bigger and more muscular, while one was skinnier with thin features. By the time these two witnesses left, one of the girls had already begun to wipe down tables and place chairs on top of the tables. You know, like that subtle way of being like, we're closing.
Exactly.
And Jennifer was out in the lobby doing the cleaning while Eliza remained behind the counter. This couple also said that they did not know that Sarah and Amy were also in the store, as they were in the back at this time. The couple left about 5 minutes later and left the men in the shop with the girls. And the only two chairs that were left remaining on the floor when police arrived were the chairs from the table closest to the register, and the napkin dispenser on that table had not been filled as well. So, interesting.
Yeah, so like it points to these gentlemen.
Yeah.
Either leaving right before it happened and they didn't have time to clean up their table, or the gentleman being the ones to commit the crime.
Which I personally lean towards them being the gentleman who committed the crime.
Yeah, me too.
It was theorized that more than one person had committed the murders, as the bullets used to kill the girls came from two different kinds of guns. For the week after, both schools that the girls had attended had grief counselors on site for grieving students. On Monday, December 9th, a vigil was held for the girls at St. Louis Catholic Church, where more than 1,000 people attended. A second vigil was held a week after the murder at the yogurt shop, where people had a moment of silence for the victims and paid their respects to the families. Bryce Foods, the company that owned the yogurt shop, put together a $25,000 reward for information on who committed the crime. They also met with all of the families to give their condolences and help in any way possible. A billboard was put up in Austin with pictures of the four girls saying, "Who killed these girls?" In the days following the murders, the police were bombarded with tips coming into the station. Investigator Mike Huckabee said, "The phone never quit ringing. There would be stacks and stacks and stacks of tip sheets on the desks."
So 8 days after the murder, police finally got a lead. A local teenager, 16-year-old Maurice Pierce, had been arrested at the North Cross Mall for carrying a loaded .22 caliber pistol in his waistband. He had been arrested alongside his friend, Forrest Welburn, who was 15. The two were interviewed, and Maurice confessed to the crime while Welburn denied his involvement in the murders altogether. Maurice went on to basically throw Forrest under the bus and say that he was the one who committed the murders. Hector Polanco was the detective responsible for interviewing these suspects. Maurice would also throw out two other names in the crime. He said his friends Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott had helped him steal a Nissan Pathfinder and drove it to San Antonio for a weekend getaway. And also, it never said, but I feel like since they were minors, they should have had their parents there.
Oh, absolutely. They probably did the same. Like, we'll talk about it later, but I see a lot about these boys similarly to, like, the When They See Us case.
Yeah.
The Central Park Five, because, like, stop asking underage kids to fucking interview with you without a parent present. Yeah. Like, just stop doing it. I don't understand.
So the two boys were given a polygraph test, and they both pass. Maurice was unable to really offer up any proof that he was responsible for the crime other than his words, and even the ballistics test from his weapon came back inconclusive. Eventually, these boys were cleared of any involvement, and he eventually recanted his statement.
Yeah, he recanted his confession and everything.
Jennifer's boyfriend was also questioned, as his DNA was found on the body, but he was eliminated as a suspect when he told investigators that he and Jennifer had had sex at his house prior to her going to work. There had also been a string of robberies in the area recently, with the clothing store that was next door to the yogurt shop being broken into multiple times previously.
Yeah.
And it was like 8 times.
Jesus.
And police obviously believe that this could have been related.
By the end of December, after having interviewed upwards of 100 people and not getting anywhere, police released a profile of the killers with the help from the FBI. And this is just some of the profile, as profiles are typically very long and that's boring. You don't want to hear us ramble. So it was believed that this crime was not planned out, but that the person or persons responsible were familiar with the area due to their successful and quick getaway. At least 2 people were involved, and the leader was a dominant personality and would be an explosive and impulsive person. The second person was likely to be remorseful and would likely come forward in the future. It was also likely that they had a history of fire-related crimes and potentially had a criminal record that reflected this. They believed that both men were white and would be in their late teens, early 20s. January and February, police turned their focus to people who had an interest in the occult or identified as Satanist.
Yeah, because remember, this is the early 90s, so it's like in the prime time of the satanic panic. Yes. And all that shit.
It's infuriating to read this, yeah. Though. At one point in the investigation, they had over 350 suspects. They began targeting people who, to me, were literally just goths. They wore black, had tattoos, and may have listened to heavy metal music. It wasn't even like they all did, just some of them did.
So me in high school?
Yeah, like just it doesn't make sense. And they started referring to these individuals as PIBS, which stands for people slash person in black.
Is it like Men in Black? Are they FBI agents?
I don't know. It's just so absurd.
It is.
Like, I wear all black all the time, so I don't understand.
All I wear to the gym is all black on everything constantly. Yeah,
pretty much. And this whole process was later criticized by the members of the occult community, saying that it was just a way to shut these individuals down. Because, like we said, Austin was a small town at the time, so if you had people who were, like, into the occult, everyone knew who that person was.
Yep.
Police also, at some point, questioned Kenneth Allen McDuff, who was a known serial killer at the time, and his victims were teenagers. He was ruled out as a suspect and said, "Had I done it, I would tell you because I'd be proud of it." He ended up being executed for his other crimes in 1998, and on the day of his execution, he confessed to the murders. But his fingerprints and DNA were tested against ones that they had found in the yogurt shop, and nothing matched. So it was determined that he had falsely confessed to the crime on the day of execution in hopes to get a stay of execution. Which, yeah, obviously, that's what he was doing.
Right.
And, like, just as a nice side note, in 1992, when it would have been time for Jennifer and Eliza to graduate, even though the girls wouldn't be able to walk, the school left two seats empty during the ceremony as a tribute to the girls.
Yeah, I thought that was really sweet.
That is really sweet.
In March of 1992, police released a sketch of a young man that was believed to be in the area the night of the murders. He had been seen inside of an older four-door white vehicle believed to be a Chevy. He was described as being 5'4", weighing approximately 140 pounds, and had long, straight hair that reached past his neck and could be of Hispanic descent. When this was released, people drew similarities between this sketch and one that had been released in November in connection with another local case. Three men kidnapped a woman from outside of a nightclub and would drive her to San Antonio. And this woman was sexually assaulted the whole time that she was abducted. She survived and was able to tell police what happened. One of the men from this event looked very similar to the man from the yogurt shop case. Mexican authorities identified the sketch as Albert Jimenez Cortez. He was a member of a Mexican motorcycle gang, and Albert and two other men were identified, and all three of these men left the Austin area shortly after the yogurt shop murders and fled to Mexico.
Yeah.
The men confessed to the crime, but recanted their confessions almost immediately, saying that they were tortured by officials during their interviews. They were tried for the rape case, but were not charged with the murders. There was very little evidence connecting them to the crime, and the sketch was released just as someone that they wanted to speak to, not necessarily a full-blown suspect.
Yeah.
These three men have never officially been cleared as suspects, but investigators don't believe that they truly really have any involvement in the case.
Like, when you can't 100% cross that person off your list, but they're like, we really don't think it was them.
Yeah. Like, there's no evidence to convict them or to set them free, essentially.
Yeah.
Altogether, police would later say that they had more than 50 people falsely confess to the murders. And later, it would be discovered that Detective Hector Polanco was coercing confessions out of people, and he would end up being removed from the task force for this.
And he actually eventually got removed from the APD entirely. But then I think he was reinstated or some bullshit like that.
They always are.
Yeah. But he just, like, was super fucking aggressive in all of his interviews and used intimidation tactics.
Mm-hmm. In 1992, the reward for information to a capture in this case increased to $125,000, which was the highest reward offered at the time for any crime in the Austin area.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
It is. It jumped up by $100,000.
Yeah. By 1994, the case hadn't really progressed much at all. Police didn't have a ton of evidence and didn't have a lot of leads on suspects. Although the families of the girls didn't have answers, they did get some type of relief. The year before, they had filed a lawsuit against the yogurt chain itself and the local franchise. They said that they had not done what they could to protect its teenage employees, and that with the break-ins prior, additional security should have been on the premises.
They're not wrong.
They aren't wrong. In January of 1994, they reached a settlement where they were awarded $12 million. They used a chunk of it to set up a nonprofit organization in the girls' honor called We Will Not Forget, SAJE. And they would also distribute safety materials to local schools and businesses to help prevent issues like these happening in the future.
I know, like, all of these cases are so sad, but, mm-hmm. like, the families always put together some, like, really great, like, organizations and stuff.
Yeah.
And there's always, like, usually some sort of good that comes from it.
Yeah, it's like, sometimes you have to look at these things with a silver lining or you would just be depressed all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And all of the families had actually moved out of the Austin area before this suit came to a resolution because they simply couldn't live there any longer, which is totally understandable.
Mm-hmm.
In 1996, Detective Paul Johnson was chosen to oversee the investigation. And he had to reorganize literally everything in the case before he could dive into it because it was just craziness.
Yeah.
At the time, information had already been collected on more than 1,200 suspects. There were 5,000 handwritten notes and a computer case file that had more than 10,000 pages of reports and logs.
That is insane.
Yeah. And it would take actual years for all of this information to be rearranged in a manner in which it made sense.
In 1999, 8 years after the murder, the case was announced that it was officially being reopened.
Yeah.
And on October 6th, a press conference occurred where police announced that they had arrested 4 young men and were charging them with the murder. The 4 men, may jog some memories, were Maurice Pierce, Forrest Wellborn, Michael Scott, and Robert Springsteen, the 4 boys that were questioned originally.
Yeah.
But in 1999, when all 4 men were adults and had gotten married and started their families, their names began to resurface again. Investigators found interest in the original confession and decided to interview the boys again. But this time, they interviewed all 4.
Yeah.
Because originally, they only did Forrest and Maurice.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the first time Maurice and Forrest, I just combined their names, that they gave up other names and those people were never spoken to until 8 years later.
It's because bizarre.
Realistically, they should have been spoken to the first time, even with him recanting his confession, just to talk, just to hear things out, you know, like as you have to exhaust all options in a case.
Exactly. Especially because they had 350 suspects. Like, yeah. What is 2 more?
Yeah. Just exhaust all options. That's all we're asking.
So Michael Scott.
Yeah.
And definitely not the Michael Scott from The Office.
Yeah.
Because he would never be so cruel.
I mean, he might be. If he snapped one day.
Right. So Michael Scott had an interview on September 9th, 1999. Where he ended up confessing, giving police, like, a lot of information that wasn't public.
Right.
Such as the items used to bind the girls' hands together and the location of the bodies.
Which is weird.
Yeah. But again, you'll learn that these were kind of pushed.
Yeah.
In this interview, Michael is seen having a gun placed up to his head by the detective trying to get him to confess.
Yeah.
He also says, I remember looking at this girl. I hear the gun go off. I only pulled the trigger once. I hear another gun go off. I think I hear a total of 5 shots. The detective interviewing him responds, "Come on, Michael, you're doing good. Tell us. Let's do this today. Let's do it." So Michael replies, "I remember one girl screaming, terrified." At one point, Michael also says that he thinks he needs a lawyer, but the interrogators don't stop questioning him in order to get him a lawyer.
Yeah.
Like, apparently they walked out of the room for a couple minutes and then just walked back in and kept questioning him. Another portion of Michael's interview showed that he was uncertain of some of the details of the crime and perhaps pushed.
I'm sorry, I just read that and that's the stupidest conversation I've ever seen.
So, the police officer says, "Well, what did you use to tie up the girls?" Michael says, "Venetian blind cords?"
Why would there be Venetian blind cords?
So it was a fancy
in this yogurt
shop.
Like, I do not understand.
It was the bougiest
shop. It gets better, guys. It gets better.
So the police officer says, "Not Venetian blind cords." So Michael goes, napkins?
It's not funny, but it's funny. I'm sorry.
So the police officer responds, "You can't tie somebody up with napkins."
Yeah, like,
and they just kept going.
They basically just keep leading him until he finally says the right answer.
Yeah, and was like, "Well, what else is in the shop that could be used to tie him up?"
Like, it's just, it's crazy.
It is. And Michael was interrogated for 20 hours total, which will break you down at some point. Robert Springsteen was interviewed next, and he originally denied any involvement, but then eventually confessed to all boys planning to rob the shop and then rape and murder the girls inside. In his interview, the detective is heard coercing Robert to say that he raped the girls, so he did. Through these two confessions, police were able to piece together what happened. Shortly before closing, one of the boys snuck in and unlocked the back door so they would have an entry point. Forrest Wellborn, who was only 15 at the time and the youngest, stayed outside and acted as a lookout, while the other three boys, aged 16, 17, and 18, went in through the back door, committed the robbery, sexually assaulted at least 2 of the victims, killed the girls, set the place on fire, and left.
Yeah.
And Forrest apparently, like, walked away from the scene after a few minutes of waiting. Like, he was done with it. And the boys picked him up afterwards walking down the road.
The thing that's interesting is, like, it could technically be the kid who went into the bathroom and didn't see come out, because he could have snuck out and gone in and, like, unlocked the back door. It's totally a possibility.
Oh, yeah, because it's right next to the back door. We'll post, like, a picture of the layout of the store.
Yeah.
And the bathroom is, like, you kind of have to go through the entrance of the back to get into the back room.
Yeah.
Bathroom.
So it easily could have been them, but I'd still be interested in those other two men personally.
Definitely.
In the October press conference, after saying that 4 men had been arrested for the murders, Mayor Kirk Watson stated, "On December 6, 1991, we as a city lost our innocence. Today, we regain our confidence." But investigators started running into roadblocks of the case. Maurice's original confession in 1991 would not be admissible in court, after it had been thrown out, especially since it was given to Detective Hector Polanco, who was known to coerce confessions out of people. Prosecutors would be able to use the confessions of Michael and Robert against them in court, but would have to find more evidence against Maurice and Forrest, since they denied involvement in the murders, as a law in Texas made it impossible for a co-conspirator's confession being the only evidence linking someone to a crime, which is good.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I can't just walk up to the police station and be like, "Morgan killed somebody."
Yeah. Like, we killed someone together, but she killed them more than I did.
Yeah.
Loved ones of the suspects did not believe that they would have been able to commit these crimes, as none of them had been violent, and they had only records of petty crime, One had a weed charge, a DUI, etc. Nothing violent, just dumb.
Yeah.
Family members of the two men who confessed said that police had used intimidation tactics to get the men to falsely confess, citing their lack of education and needing to take special ed classes as being especially impressionable in nature. By December, police had indicted three of the men on the charge of murder, all except Forrest, who had posted bond. And since he was outside the building for the murders, he had not known of the violence happening inside. In June of 2000, the prosecution decided to drop charges against Forrest as he was unable to be indicted by a grand jury.
So the first actual trial to happen was Robert Springsteen's, and it occurred in April of 2001. He was being charged with the murder of Amy Ayers. The prosecution wanted to charge him with only one case in case he was acquitted, and then they could charge him with the other murders later on.
Yeah, because of double jeopardy.
Yep. At this point, Robert had recanted his confession and was pleading not guilty. And he had said about his confession, "I was berated and berated and berated by the police officers until they obtained what it was they wanted to hear. They were not going to allow me to leave, and basically, they broke me down." And even though the only real evidence was his and Michael Scott's confession tapes, in June of 2001, he was found guilty of the murder and sentenced to death after the jury deliberated for 2 days.
I'd be interested, because I didn't think to look that up until right this second. Was this held in Austin? Like, was the jury pulled from Austin? Because if so, that's crazy.
So what I read was that the jury pool consisted of 200 people.
Mm-hmm.
Only one person had never heard of the murders.
Yeah, that's insane.
But I mean, being 8-10 years later, like, it's going to be hard to find someone in even Texas, I bet, who would haven't heard of it.
Still, I think, like, a lot of cases we covered, like, Austin as a, like, place has repeatedly said we lost our innocence with this case.
Mm-hmm.
And to have people from Austin who this is the turning point case in their lives do the jury seems wrong. Like, yeah. They should have pulled, even if it's from somewhere else in Texas, even if they still know about the murders, you can't pull from the place that is constantly referring to this murder as the reason they fucking lost their innocence.
Exactly. And, like, because it was so widely spread and, like, yeah, the biggest case and talked about all the time, people were obviously looking for a scapegoat and, yeah, someone to blame.
Yeah. And it would be really easy to do that when you see two guys confess, but there's no other fucking evidence.
Exactly.
Like, there's not any other physical evidence. So what are we doing here, guys?
So frustrating. So Michael Scott's trial was next, and it began in July of 2002. Like Robert, he recanted his confession and was pleading not guilty. Again, the only evidence against him was his taped confession. Michael's defense stated that he had been intimidated and coerced into confessing as, like we said earlier, part of his confession tape showed that during the interrogation, Detective Merrill had held a gun to his head. And Detective Merrill said that this was actually a common tactic used to help jog memories. Like, what? No. That's a tactic used to scare the shit out of people.
Yeah, that's insane to say, oh, this is a common tactic. No, it's not.
And something that we will touch on later, but I feel like it's important to say now as well, is that neither Robert or Michael got to go to the witness stand and be interviewed or anything like that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know if they were in the actual courtroom for their trials because they only showed the confession tapes.
That's insane.
And that is it.
Yeah. That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a real trial.
Exactly.
Like, it's just not. That's a farce of a trial.
So, Michael Scott was also only charged with Amy Ayers' murder in order to charge him later, yeah, if he was acquitted. But on September 22nd, 2002, he was also found guilty and he was sentenced to life in prison, where the other guy was sentenced to death. Maurice Pierce's trial was set to begin April 21st, 2003. And Maurice was labeled as the ringleader of the group, according to Robert and Michael's confessions. But the prosecution found themselves unable to take him to trial, as there was no evidence against him, he didn't confess, and they were unable to use Robert and Michael's recanted confessions against him.
Yeah.
So, in January of 2003, Maurice was released from police custody, and all charges were dropped against him.
This is just so baffling, because we had these two men get pulled in right when the murder happened. And later, those same two men are pulled in with their other two friends. And those two friends are the only one who actually have something happen to them.
Exactly.
The people who did not get interviewed after the murders first occurred. What?
I know, like we said it earlier, but it's like the Central Park Five, where the Corey kid, I can't remember his last name, mm-hmm. but where Corey was just with his friend and wasn't on the original list of suspects.
Yeah.
And they took his friend in and was like, oh, do you want to interview with your, like, do you want to be at the station to support your friend? And he's like, okay, I guess I will. And he's the one who gets, like, the worst treatment.
Yeah. It's baffling to me. And it seems like we just want a scapegoat to write this case off, and we found the murderers. We're done.
There is justice.
Yeah. In the years following, a new Texas law came out that said anyone who was a minor at the time of committing their crimes could not be sentenced to death, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
So Robert Springsteen's sentence got changed to life in prison, as he had been under 18 at the time of the murders. In 2006, Robert appealed his conviction, based on the fact that he had an unfair trial. Because the defense was unable to cross-examine Michael Scott about his confession during the trial, and on a 5-4 ruling, his conviction was overturned. During his trial, Robert was never brought to the stand, and the prosecution just used his taped confession, meaning that he had never had the chance to confront his accuser, which is a violation of his constitutional rights. Shortly after, Michael's appeal came through, and his conviction was also overturned for the same reason as Robert's. He wasn't able to confront his accuser. Both men remained in prison, though, in case a retrial occurred.
Which does not make any sense, because the charges were dropped.
Yep. Doesn't make any sense. In 2008, the defense called for DNA testing to take place against the suspects. And since DNA technology was more advanced now, the judge allowed it. Vaginal swabs were taken from all four victims, and the results showed that multiple people had committed the crime. But when compared to the DNA of the four suspects they already had, there was no match. The prosecution decided that without a DNA match, they would not be able to retry the case, and in June 2009, District Attorney Rosemary Lemberg announced that they were not prepared to move forward in the case. On June 24th, 2009, the two men were released from jail after being behind bars for just months shy of a decade. And in October, the charges against the men were completely dropped. 7 out of 12 jurors in the case said that they would not have convicted the men if they had known about the results from the DNA testing that happened afterwards. Forrest, Robert, and Michael struggled getting their life back together after the case, but eventually were able to do so and had no run-ins with the law and have maintained their innocence. Maurice Pierce, on the other hand, ended up being shot and killed by a police officer in 2010, after a struggle ensued following a traffic stop, Maurice pulled a knife and cut the police officer in the throat. He was then shot and died while the police waited on an ambulance.
In the DNA testing that took place in 2009, it revealed that there were 3 different genetic profiles present, and this is not including the DNA from Jennifer's boyfriend.
Yeah.
The DNA recovered from Amy Ayer's body was a YSTR strand of DNA, which is passed down through the male Y chromosome. This DNA could potentially be used to track down male lineage in order to find the person responsible for the crime, like in the Golden State Killer case.
Yeah. And fun fact, if you aren't aware, well, what's today? The 29th?
Yep.
June 29th, the day we're recording, the Golden State Killer pled guilty to 12 murders.
I thought it was just to the first one, first count.
Oh, I read that he... It was to all 12 different murders.
Oh.
But I don't know. Maybe not.
Who knows? But he at least is getting there. He's pleading guilty.
Yeah, he's pleading guilty. He knows he's stuck.
Exactly. Texas police sent this DNA to a lab in Virginia that specialized in this kind of thing. They also collected DNA samples from patrons of the yogurt shop, the girls' friends, classmates, anyone that they could have believed to have been a part of the murders, and sent them to this lab to be tested. They also took samples of all of the first responders and people who would have been at the crime scene in order to rule out that DNA, and all of these tests turned out negative. Then there was a huge feud between the FBI and the Texas State Police, and it's still going on till to today.
Yeah, there's a bunch of articles in like March of 2020 about this still.
And this happened after the DNA strand was sent over by the FBI to the University of Central Florida's National Center for Forensic Science in 2017, who has a large male-only DNA database. And a match was identified here. But the issue is the FBI refuses to give the specific information over to police.
Yeah.
The FBI does say that they have not revealed this information because even though there was a match, this strand of DNA could be linked to thousands of men. And I didn't write this, but like the police have said that like they're aware that it could be linked to thousands of men, mm-hmm. and they are more than happy and prepared to go through thousands of possible connections.
Yeah.
And like they're willing to do the work if they are given the answers.
Yeah, because here's the thing. You could probably actually like narrow that down pretty quickly. Like, yeah. Has this person ever been to Texas? Have they ever like you exactly. could narrow that down very quickly and get to a smaller base and still then do the work, because like with the Golden State Killer case, it wasn't even his DNA that was like found, it was his son's.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're even just getting a name that's on the suspect list, like who's a descendant of that person, you know, like
exactly,
it's just it's something they could definitely do.
Yeah. And they said they're more than happy and prepared to do it.
Yeah.
They just need the information and they'll put in the hard work.
Yeah.
So Bob Ayers, who is Amy's father, is obviously upset and frustrated that this information has not been released.
As I would be too.
Yes. And he said in an interview, "Isn't it against the law to withhold evidence in a murder case? All we've ever done is ask for help. And now that we've found something, we can't get it." In a separate interview, Bob Ayers says that he realizes that he's getting older, but keeps repeating, "I will not die until this case is resolved."
So fucking sad.
It is. Amy's mother, Pam Ayers, said, "Everybody needs a resolution. Every time we think we made a little headway, we take steps backwards. My hope is dimming considerably, unfortunately. If this can't be done, I think it's time for a change in the laws."
Yeah. Yeah, this case is going to be 30 next year.
Exactly.
Like, they deserve answers.
Mm-hmm. And in February of this year, U.S. Representative Michael McCaul sent a letter to the FBI's laboratory division asking them to release the information that may be useful in the investigation. He wrote in the letter, "As a member of Congress, a former federal prosecutor, a concerned member of the Austin community, and a father of teenage daughters, I urge the Bureau to work with the state to provide this important information to authorities in Texas as soon as possible, as they work to secure long overdue justice for Amy, Eliza, Jennifer, Sarah, and their families.
And to this day, this case technically remains unsolved. Investigators involved still believe that the four boys are responsible, despite all evidence presented. And like we've said throughout this, it's much like the Central Park 5 case, where it seems that the investigators landed on an answer and just don't care to look any further.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully with this new DNA stuff, like, they're gonna look further.
Yeah, especially if more people know that the FBI is doing this.
Yeah.
Like, the more the word gets out, the more that there's a chance they'll release the information.
Exactly. The Austin police is often criticized for being tunnel visioned about this case, and people believe that if someone with new eyes and no background knowledge on the case would come in, that they would not come to the same conclusion that the four boys were responsible.
Mm-hmm.
The two men who were seen in the shop about 10 minutes before closing have never been located in question. In fact, they are the only witnesses that night that have never been contacted. Until they are cleared, they are personally still a very big person of interest in this case to me.
And should be.
Yeah. Like, to me, that seems fishy that you know that it happened with at least two men, and the two men who were there right before, their seats are still on the floor.
I know.
Like, it's just so infuriating. It's like, maybe it's not a simple answer. Maybe it's not those two guys, but the fact that we have never found them and talked to them is kind of fishy to me.
I know it was the early 90s, but I'm like, if there were just security cameras, we would have had all the questions answered.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So next year will be the 30th anniversary of the crimes, and the families still do hold hopes out that the case will be solved. Unfortunately, Maria Thomas, mother of Eliza, did pass away in 2015, but the remaining family and siblings are still alive and seeking justice. Today, the site where the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt shop was is now the location of a nail salon called Classy Nail Salon. In front of the salon, under an oak tree, is a bronze plaque that is in memory of the girls. The workers of the salon place items there for the girls every day, whether it be apples, donuts, candles, or coins. On every Chinese New Year, the workers place red envelopes of money at the plaque for the girls. And the workers also said that some of the family members come into the shop and check on the plaque, which is... it's nice that, like, they're maintaining this legacy of these mm-hmm. girls. It's very it sweet.
But yeah, that is a sad case. It's so frustrating because you feel like the answers are right there.
Yeah.
And
I have heard this case several times mm-hmm. on other podcasts, and I don't think I've ever, like, left feeling as frustrated as I did, like, actually researching the case.
Definitely.
Because a lot of podcasts that cover this are in the setup where they do, like, one half is a different story and the other half is a different story. So they're limited to time. But once we could, like, actually dig into this case and, like, look at it more, there's just a lot of stuff that's, like, come on, guys, we can be doing better.
Exactly.
But yeah, we hope that you guys liked this one. It's a bit of a long one because we're rambling, so we're sorry. But do you have a Florida man that's gonna make us a little less pissed off?
I sure hope so. And this Florida man is from a couple years ago, because right now all of the Florida man cases would piss you off.
Yeah, right now it's just like, hi, I don't want to wear a mask. I'm going to shit in it and throw it at you.
Exactly.
Like, that's what Florida's doing right now.
The first, like, 10 articles are like, man punches shop owner in the face for being asked to put on a mask.
Yeah.
And you're like, stop.
We're really sorry, guys. Florida is the penis of America.
Honestly. So, this one, it's a little better.
Yeah.
Drunken man with kitten refused entry to strip club, repeatedly dialed 911. So deputies were called to the Emerald City nightclub.
Yeah.
After the owner told Everett Robert Leggies to leave after the 47-year-old Port Charlotte man tried to bring a kitten into the strip club in Murdoch. But instead of leaving, he sat down outside and dialed 911. When the deputies arrived and spoke with him, they noted he appeared to be drunk and told him he needed to leave the premises and even called a taxi for him. When the taxi arrived, Lagus would not provide the cabbie with an address and would not say whether he had any money for the fare. He allegedly then began to yell and cause a scene, insisting that the club owner had committed a crime and continued to call 911 on his cell phone, even though deputies were right there. And the deputies ordered him to stop calling 911, explaining that continuing to do so in the presence of law enforcement was a crime, but he refused to hang up the phone and refused to exit the taxi. So he was then placed under arrest. He was charged with misuse of the 911 system, disorderly intoxication, trespassing after warning, and resisting arrest without violence. No word on the cat.
I was going to say, what happened to the cat?
I don't know, but they were like, it's a baby kitten. Like, it was small. And I read so many, like, not professional news articles about this.
Yeah.
That made a lot of, like, maybe they thought it would, like, maybe he thought that they were talking about a different kind of pussy kind
nice.
Of thing, like bringing the cat in. And I was like, this is too much.
We're going to keep it with the news sources.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is incredible.
Exactly.
Truly. I do hope that the kitten is good, landed in a safe place.
I do hope that they start allowing animals in strip clubs.
Yeah, like, fuck your allergies, man.
Exactly. I would love, like, a strip club where I got to pet puppies as well.
Yeah. It'd be... it would definitely be interesting,
it
to
would.
Say the least. All right, guys. We hope that you enjoyed this week's episode. Make sure that you check us out on social media. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. You know, the social media.
Exactly. If you want to reach out to us, you can also email us at crimebinge@gmail.com. And please remember, if you are on Apple Podcasts, to rate and review. It only takes like 5 seconds and it does a world of good for us.
Yeah. And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.